everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show planned for all of you today. I'm so excited to be welcoming back Frances Moore LaPay, also known as Frankie to her friends. She is the author of Diet for a Small Planet, and we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of this book. And that is why I've invited her on. And that is the book that started me on my path to eating healthy. And I'm just a big, big fan of Frankie's, and I'm so excited to have her on. But first, before she comes on, I want to share with you some things going on in the news, some ways you can take action, and of course, share my recipe with you. So I wanted to share with you yesterday, I was invited back to Southampton Hospital. I've been doing this for many years now, but of course last year, because of the pandemic, we had skipped it. But I do a cooking demo for interns at Southampton Hospital. And these are 40 interns that are going to go out and have patients and, you know, be doctors. And they are learning about healthy eating, which is not part of a normal medical education. And the doctor that is in charge of the residency program at Southampton Hospital is a big fan. And he really knows that food makes a difference and that food is medicine. And he is imparting that knowledge onto his students. So it was great. We had some cold sesame noodles made with rice noodles. Everything was organic and vegan and gluten-free. Did have nuts in the desserts. So if that was the only allergy sensitivity, I think. But we had cold sesame noodles, some vegan sushi. I make a great sushi roll with some sauteed onions and carrots and also avocado rolls. Then I did a stir fry demonstration for them with, you know, over 12 different freshly cut vegetables and some vegetarian fried rice. And so it was great. And then for dessert, we had the raspberry lemon cheesecake that's made with a cashew cream and some little Linzer tarts. And it was just so wonderful because they were really engaged. They were really curious. They wanted to know how they, on a medical student salary, which is very little, how they can actually eat organic. And I shared with them tips with from the Environmental Working Group, how they have the Clean 15 list and the Dirty Dozen. So you can learn about which vegetables are most important to get organic and which ones are not as important. So all of you should know about that too. EWG.org is the website, the Environmental Working Group. And then of course, also the scorecards that Cornucopia Institute puts out, you know, that rates all the milk and all the eggs, you know, all the dairy. So, you know, I always say every broccoli is not the same, you know, one organic broccoli can be much better if it's raised in a small farm than even organic broccoli that's raised, you know, in a 1,000-acre farm. So where you get your food really makes a difference. Who grew it makes a difference. And it was just really wonderful to share that with everyone. And then I also, this past weekend, was out at the Cornell Cooperative Extension's Family Fun Day at their farm in East Meadow, where we did a cooking demo there. There were over 300 families at this event. There was live music, but I think we may have been the highlight. I had a slow food table there. We were sharing the message of slow food, which is good, clean, and fair food for the environment and for your body, and a cooking demo as well. And then the evening was topped off by a fundraiser at Orchestai Farm, which is a nonprofit farm located here at the Planting Fields Arboretum. And this farm works with autistic children and children that have other emotional needs. And they have a CSA program, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful setting, a beautiful farm, a beautiful mission. And we did a stuffed Long Island cheese pumpkin for that event, as well as some gluten-free pesto. And so again, I just did a whole bunch of cooking this week, and I have been not doing a lot of cooking during this pandemic week. So it's just so great to be back in my element and meeting people and talking about food, which is what I love to talk about. So I also want to share with you some things that are in the news. Of course, unfortunately, because I had all these cooking events, I was not able to participate in the Women's March on Saturday that took place across the country. There were over 600 marches across the country, pushing for freedom of choice. The new law in Texas, although I just heard that a federal judge just put a hold on that law, so we'll see what happens. But the law in Texas that allows and encourages people to tell on people who are having abortions is just horrendous. And freedom of choice is really so important. And it actually drives me crazy when I hear people using the, you know, my body, my choice as a right for not getting vaccinated. But meanwhile, they don't want you to have a choice of freedom of birth control. So, you know, if you want freedom of choice, my body, my choice, that goes across the board. So I really am in support of freedom of choice. And I would have loved to take a place in the marches, but it was really wonderful to see so many marches taking place across the country, although a little disappointing that it did not make more of the news. And then I also wanted to share a great article that I put in my newsletter about home births and about how wonderful home births are for people, especially during this time of the pandemic, when people going into a hospital is a dangerous place. It's not necessarily where you want to go to bring new life in. And that home birth is a really wonderful, viable option. However, unfortunately, we need to push for insurance companies to pay for it. Right now, we have the worst woman and child mortality rate of any industrialized Western country. It's inexcusable. And yet we have the most expensive medical care. So it just doesn't make sense. And when you're in a hospital, your risk of having a C-section or some intervention is much greater. And most births are normal, natural life cycle events. They're not a medical event. Hospitals can turn them into a medical event, but most of the time they're not a medical event. And so you do have choices. And I just shared an article and a website for you to really check out some of the choices that you have and ways that you can try to get your insurance company to pay for home births, which is really important. Under my take action this week, I asked everybody to sign petitions to stop the Line 3 pipeline, which is part of the tar sands disaster that goes from Alberta, Canada, all the way through the United States to Wisconsin. You know, there's so many pipelines. I mean, if you pull up a video of the pipelines, you wouldn't believe how many pipelines there are right now. And pipelines do leak. They leak constantly. You know, I shared that we just witnessed actually the pipeline that broke this past weekend in off the coast of Southern California, which allowed 126,000 gallons of oil into the water. But pipelines leak, they always leak. And they say right now there's an average of 200 barrels of oil that leaks daily with pipelines. So it's really a problem. Please sign the petitions. Let your Congress people know that you want to transition to renewable energy. We need to get off of this fossil fuel. Pipelines are bad news for everyone except for the companies that are pushing it. So please sign that petition. Then there's also a petition to stop the use of pesticides because they're killing our pollinators, which we need our pollinators in order to fertilize our food. And we just need pollinators, and pesticides are bad for the environment and for our health. So please sign that petition too. And now I want to share with you my recipe this week. I made pumpkin soup. Pumpkins are coming out of the garden faster than I can eat them. Pumpkin soup is a great way of using a whole pumpkin in one recipe, and it freezes really well. So this recipe makes about 18 cups. But like I said, you can freeze it if it's too much for you. This is a 8 to 10 pound pumpkin. I have lots of Long Island cheese pumpkins coming out, which is a wonderful heirloom variety. It is one of the special crops that Slow Food has been highlighting. And so I try to use it a lot. You need one Long Island cheese pumpkin or another pumpkin of your choice. If you can get an organic one, of course, that's ideal. 10 cups of water, 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, 1 tablespoon of minced garlic, 2 tablespoons of fresh minced ginger, 2.5 teaspoons of salt, 1 onion chopped, 4 carrots cut, 4 potatoes cut into chunks, 1 can of coconut milk, 4 tablespoons of maple syrup, 2 teaspoons of cinnamon, 1 tablespoon of cardamom, and 2 teaspoons of coriander. So you lay the pumpkin out, cut side down. So you first cut it in half, obviously. Cut it, lay it cut side down after you've already scooped out all of the seeds. You can put it onto some parchment paper that you spray with a little oil just to keep it from sticking. And you can make a few slits in the top of the pumpkin just to let some of the steam out so that it's not sitting in all the water. And you're going to bake it at 375 for approximately an hour until the pumpkin is soft. Let it cool a bit before scooping out all the pulp, and the juice is really good too. And leave the skin aside and just put that into your compost. Meanwhile, while that's roasting in a large stock pot, you can saute the onions, the potatoes, and the carrots in the little bit of coconut oil, along with the ginger and the garlic. Add the spices and lightly toast that for about 2 minutes to allow the spice flavor to really, the aroma from the spices to come out. Then you're going to add the pumpkin pulp to the stock pot and the 10 cups of water. The pumpkin should be covered with the liquid by 3 inches or so. So if you need a little bit more water, just add a little more water and bring that to a boil. Reduce the heat and let that simmer for about 30 minutes. Remove it from the heat and using an immersion blender, puree the soup until smooth. If you don't have an immersion blender, you can, of course, put it into cups of it into a Cuisinart or food processor, or you can put it into a blender. Or you can just keep cooking it until it just falls apart by itself. That will work too. Remove from, and then you return it to the stove, add the coconut milk. And if the soup is too thick, you can add some more water, add the maple syrup, and then adjust the spices to your liking. So if you want it a little sweeter, you can add a little more maple syrup. Cardamom is a wonderful flavor. You can add that. And then if you want to add any fresh parsley or cilantro, that's also delicious in there. And that is it. I hope you all make it and enjoy it. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Frances Moore LaPay. As I said, she's known to her friends as Frankie. She's the author of Diet for a Small Planet, which is the book that inspired me 48 years ago to become a vegetarian. She's also the author of 20 other books, or co-author of 20 other books, about world hunger, living democracy, and the environment. Frankie has been featured on The Today Show, Hardball with Chris Matthews, Fox and Friends, The Wall Street Journal, NPR, CBS, PBS, and other news outlets. She's the co-founder of 3 organizations, including Food First, which is a wonderful Oakland-based think tank, the Small Planet Institute, which she leads with her daughter, Anna LaPay, who has also been a guest on my show. And they've also co-founded the Small Planet Fund, which channels resources to democratic social movements worldwide. So welcome, Frankie.
Thank you so much. I'm so excited to be with you again.
Thank you. So I have so many questions to ask you, but first I just want to thank you for your book and your contribution to everybody who cares about food, because Diet for a Small Planet set me on my path 48 years ago. I've never turned back. And it's just wonderful.
You're soaring. I just from what you were saying and all the recipes and all the things you're doing, it's so thrilling to see you soaring.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, you are too. And we need lots of us to be flying around doing this good work so that we can improve what's going on in our world. So what are the most inspiring changes you've seen since you first wrote Diet for a Small Planet? And what's the most alarming?
Well, there is a huge awareness compared to when I began. And I say that I was a heretic, you know, challenging what many people thought was the ultimate, you know, food system. We're modern, we're industrialized, we're not backward like those people. And so I think there's a great deal more awareness of the waste and their, you know, waste or inefficiency, however you want to put it, extreme inefficiency of our system and the harm that it causes. And so, you know, I love it that you're emphasizing organic and plant-centered. And so I think still the numbers of people shifting is still much less than I would hope. But the awareness of the harm built into our grain-fed, meat-centered, and highly processed diet, I think there is a growing awareness. And the sales of organic, as you I'm sure know, are really going up. And I was struck and included it in the new opening chapter for the 50th anniversary edition, that a number of states in the South here in the U.S. have greatly increased. Just over a five-year period, they doubled their organic acres. And I thought that was a really great sign. So I think we're shifting, and I think we have to. And the harms to our, I mean, what is so disappointing is how much greater harm there is both to our earth in terms of species decimation and deforestation that is the consequence of this grain-fed, meat-centered fixation, and how much more harm to our bodies in terms of the, you know, it's like five-fold increase in the diabetes rate, or six-fold, depending on your numbers, since I wrote Diet for Small Planet. I mean, that's huge.
And also for children. I mean, children used to not get diabetes, and now it's a children disease as well as an adult disease.
Thank you. Yeah, it's really extreme. And I saw the estimate that a third of Americans now are either diabetic or pre-diabetic, adults, a third are either diabetic or pre-diabetic. And the other thing I've learned that just recently, maybe you probably know this, but I don't know when it happened, but the World Health Organization has designated processed meat as a carcinogen. And still, it's hot dogs, et cetera, bologna. So I've learned a lot about what's happened as I wrote the 50th anniversary edition. And so I guess the summary answer to your question is that, yes, there's much greater awareness. We have now the spreading of thousands of community gardens and farmers markets and community supported agriculture that's happening. And at the same time, our consumption of nutrition-less food and dangerous food is still so much part of our diet that now 60% of our calories come from ultra-processed food, which supply virtually no nutrition. So empty calories is the appropriate label.
Wow, 60%. It's amazing. It's amazing. You know, I talk to people and it's like, I can't even remember the last time I had a soda. I mean, you know, it was probably when I read Diet for a Small Planet when I was 16 or something. I mean, I haven't, you know, I just can't even believe people drink that. You know, it's amazing to me. What so many people eat and how good healthy food can be. I mean, that was the takeaway when we did this food demo at the Cornell Cooperative Extension Farm this weekend. So many people that were, I mean, I was right next to, and I couldn't believe they were selling hamburgers and hot dogs right next to me, but I was placed right next to where they were selling hamburgers and hot dogs. Of course, I was giving my samples away, and it was unbelievable how many people were like, oh my God, this is so good. Can you give a cooking class? Yeah. They don't know how to make it. And I joke about my first time when I got a wok, after reading your book and I decided I'm going to become a vegetarian, I went out and got a wok and I opened a can of vegetables to stir fry because that's all I knew. I had never seen a fresh broccoli in my house. You know, everything in my house was canned or frozen. So I didn't, you know, I had so much to learn, but there's so many people that are still
learning. People, of course, said to me, well, you know, how, once you started making a sacrifice, you know, giving up meat, you know, how did that feel? And I said, sacrifice? Oh my gosh. Do you realize that there are just a few kinds of meat, but there are multiple kinds of delicious vegetables? That's where all the variety is. The color, the texture is in the plant world. And so it's let go of this idea that you're depriving yourself, and then embrace the idea that you are opening yourself to the incredible taste journey of great pleasure. And so I loved kind of being just a experimenter in the kitchen and putting things together in new ways. And walk is definitely the key. I agree. Having a walk, you know, and they're so beautiful when you chop the veggies and you see the different colors in there, and they just look so appetizing. So yeah, I really try to stress that this is not a you should, but please enjoy.
Right, exactly.
Enjoy the fun, you know. Yeah.
Thank you for saying that, because it's so true. People think, oh my God, you poor thing, you just eat salad all day long. You know, it's not that at all. It's not that at all. As a matter of fact, I had some of the stuffed pumpkin left over from the event I did on Saturday, and I wrapped it in phyllo pastry. Oh my Ooh. God. It was delicious. Ooh. You know, instead of a spanico pizza, I now have like a phyllo pastry stuffed, you know, the pumpkin. It's like a, almost like a pot pie filling, you know, inside of the phyllo pastry. Came out great.
That sounds great.
So I agree with you. It opens up a whole thing. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you saw last week in the New York Times, the review in the food section of 11 Madison Park, which is a three-star restaurant that became vegan this year after the pandemic. The chef realized that, you know, doing the meat's not sustainable, even though they were purchasing sustainably raised meat, that it should be vegan. So he went vegan, but the review was horrible because as the writer wrote, he's trying to do all these meat things with the vegetables. He's covering the vegetables. So you couldn't even taste the vegetables. You didn't know what you were eating. And I just was laughing because, you know, you don't want to mask the vegetable. You want to highlight the vegetable.
Right.
You want to let people know what they're eating. You don't want to eat a cauliflower that is, you know, covered in a reduction sauce that makes you not be able to taste the cauliflower. So anyway, it's really interesting to see the bad review. Yeah. So, I wanted to ask if you could share with my listeners some of the links between the land, industrial livestock, and hunger, because that's, you know, I always talk about connecting the dots. And I don't think people always understand how all those dots are connected. Maybe you can help spread some light on that.
Well, it's complicated and it's really interesting. You know, that originally, I said from the very early days that hunger is not caused by a scarcity of food, but by a scarcity of democracy, meaning that people didn't have the power to access the food that was either there or could easily be made available. Because let me just give you one statistic or a couple maybe, but that explains the waste and inefficiency. We think, oh, we're modern and efficient. No. Listen to this. We, the human race, we devote about 80% of all agricultural land, including grazing land, we devote to livestock, but they return to us only 18% of our calories. So wait a minute, whoever thought that was efficient? And when we eat beef, the calories that the cow eats in feed, we get about 3% of those calories in the food, in the beef that we eat. So it's an incredibly, well, I called it in the first diet of First Small Planet edition, I called it a protein factory in reverse, that it's the disappearing machine. So I just tried to bust that idea that somehow, you know, that we're modern and efficient and we do things right. And just point out that we are greatly reducing the capacity of the earth to feed us. And even still, if you look at the Food and Agriculture Organization's estimates of how many calories there are per capita in the world, it's been going up. It's up 20-25% since I wrote Diet for a Small Planet. And they're now, this is the supply after all this waste, right? This is the actual supply, is about 3,000 calories per person. And that is plenty. So it's a both and, that we have all this waste, and yet there's still technically enough calories. And we're wasting so much that in many parts of the world where so much is fed to livestock, certainly we're right at they're in the lead in that, that there could be so much more available and that we wouldn't have to, you know, that if we really prioritized sustainability of diverse species so that we weren't using chemicals to destroy, you know, species. By the way, on that, it's estimated that 40% of insects could be decimated, could be gone in the next few decades because of our heavy duty chemical approach to farming in the industrial countries. So that's serious because insects are key to the whole ecosystem that produces our food, of course. So what am I saying here? I'm just saying that we should let go of the fear of scarcity and focus on the scarcity of democracy, not a scarcity of food, but democracy. How do we citizens get our common sense voices and our sense of fairness voices into our decision making? Because right now there are something like 20 lobbyists in Washington for every person that you and I have elected to represent us there. And agribusiness lobbyists outnumber the quote, even the oil and gas industry lobbyists. So it's really my theme song of my life is sung with stanzas that focus on food and agriculture and other stanzas that focus on democracy. And so my organization, Small Plant Institute, has helped create a website that's really easy to remember. It's just democracymovement.us. And so whatever passion you bring on environment, on racial justice, on food, you can weigh in there and get involved and be heard through a growing democracy movement. So we can do our food movement and our democracy movement simultaneously in a movement of movement.
That's great. Great resource. Thank you. Because, I mean, one thing we have to get rid of is the Citizens United, which has given corporations the same power or more power than the people. And, you know, with all the lobbying going on, you know, it's all about profit and bottom line and corporations, and our elected officials listen to them more than to the people. And I remember President Obama, when he said, you know, show me the movement, make me do it. You know, I mean, willing to, you know, he wanted to make some change, but in order to stand up against all those lobbyists and all those corporations and the elected officials that are paid off by those corporations, he needed to show the big movement, and we just weren't there yet. And so we really need to grow that movement. And that would be the democracy movement that you're talking about. Wonderful for all the issues, like you're saying, whether it's the home birth issue I was talking about, you know, the freedom of choice issue, the birth issue, all of them come under that umbrella of democracy. So
thank you.
So
I just want to underscore to everyone, you know, that because I think it's so encouraging to remember it wasn't always like this. I mean, we've never had a real democracy, of course. But when it's great being an elder now that I can say that I was there when Jimmy Carter ran with public financing and won.
And so put solar panels on the White House.
Thank you. Yes.
He had solar panels on the White House before Reagan took them down.
Took them down, right. So before the Reagan era that sold us this idea that we're just selfish little critters looking out for ourselves and all we need is a free market, quote unquote, which of course does not exist. All markets have rules. Before that, there was a sense that we can act for the general welfare. And by the way, the preamble to our own Constitution says that a key goal of this Constitution is to promote the general welfare. It doesn't say this is a framework for you to just be selfish and self-seeking. No. We citizens are here to promote the general welfare. And that's what it says in the preamble to our Constitution. So I think it's really important that we ground ourselves in understanding that we haven't always been in this crazy, you know, post, still in the Reagan years. And I also want to just underscore how much difference that makes in people's economic well-being. Just visualize this. My generation, born in the 40s, to my children's generation, born in the 70s, that during that period, every income quintile doubled its real family income. And the poorest gained the most, a little bit more than the rest. Whereas for my children born in the early 70s, the chart showed money rushing to the top quintile. So my point here is only a very simple one. It has not always been this way. Sense of fairness that we can trust in human beings. On that score, even capuchin monkeys have a sense of fairness. I love to cite this study where if one monkey was getting a really tasty, another monkey got a fairly, bland one, a cucumber, that the capuchin monkey finally threw the ration back to the caretaker and effectively saying, no, it's not fair. So in our species as well, that there is a deep sense of fairness. And if we feel that we're not being treated fairly, we can act out of anger and do some pretty crazy things to just sort of, just say, well, you know, I'm not even going to vote kind of approach. So we can take that sense of fairness and trust that we can build on that and connect with other people across political lines on that core value of fairness.
Yeah. And I think you're, you know, addressing living wage. I mean, you know, everyone needs to be able to make a living wage. You should be able to make a living wage and support your family with one job, not three jobs. Because if you have three jobs, then you're not home to be caring for your family properly. So you really need to be able to support yourself and your family with one job. And, you know, I've talked to so many farmers and read so much about farmers who can't even afford to buy the vegetables they're growing for us because they make so little because of the price competitiveness and the imports and the whole system is so broken.
I was just looking at a number right before this conversation about monopoly power in the food system, and that there are just three or four companies who control all the processing in meat and chicken and in the grain trade. And so the percent that farmers get has fallen by about 20% in just about a decade. And it's a tiny fraction of our dollars that we spend, and they're losing ground because of monopoly power. And that comes back to, of course, what are the rules that we set, we citizens, to prevent monopoly? Because, you know, often the Republican Party and its loyalists focus on, oh, the market. But if you have monopoly, then you don't have a fair and open market. And so it takes our stepping up and what we had a century ago or more, you know, antitrust action to break up monopolies, because otherwise we don't have a market that is competitive.
Yeah. I mean, when we go into the supermarket, people think we have all this choice, right? There's so many different choices. Right. But if you really follow who owns these different companies, I mean, even with the natural food companies that sort of start with some beautiful altruistic message, they end up selling out to a big monopoly, and they're owned by the Nestle's and the Danone's and whatever, you know. I'm sure you heard about Danone, you know, who owns Horizon Milk, you know, canceling their contracts with all the New England farmers. 89 farmers have lost their contract with their main buyer of organic milk and have to find a whole new way of selling their milk or they're out of business. So the monopolies have so much power, and we don't realize it. We think we have choice. You go into a supermarket and there's just so many choices. And it really is not so many choices. And the other thing that always I always like to remind people is that you have to constantly look at the ingredients, because as these big corporations buy up the small guys, they change the ingredients. You know, what might have been organic at one point, all of a sudden you're buying because you assume it's still organic. It's the same product. The label looks the same, but they've changed it. You know, one thing that I always, my favorite tinctures is a Zand formula, Immune Ensure, it's called. And it was Echinacea and Golden Seal. And I now looked at it, it no longer has Golden Seal in it. I can't believe it. And I've been buying that for 20 years. So I don't know at what point they took out the Golden Seal. I'm sorry, what?
Oh, it's so important what you're saying. And even more basic that I learned, learned so much in writing this new chapter for Diet for Small Planet, that actually, you know, we focus on diabetes and sugar, but added salt is such a huge health question for Americans. And that I read that one cup of Campbell's soup supplies you with 80% of your daily, you know, what should be your daily intake. And people don't realize that if you're eating processed foods, you're probably getting way too much salt as well, which is not good for us. So I just want to underscore that you're pointing out, Bhavani, that the looking at the label and seeing what it says, and avoiding, of course, the processed as much as we humanly can.
Wow, that's a huge statistic. I can't believe that 80% of your salt intake in one cup of soup. And the reality is when you sit down to a bowl of soup, you're usually having two cups of soup, not one. So you've now exceeded your daily amount, right? So often when they give you those statistics, so often the nutritional statistics on the back of a label is not the amount you're going to drink. Like you get, you know, one of those Snapple bottles and it's actually two servings. So you're looking at it thinking, oh, it's only this many calories, but it's really double that. Right. You know, or that bag of chips, you know, that, you know, looks like it's for one person is really supposed to be for 3.5 people and you've eaten the whole bag. So, yeah. Okay. So how does industrial livestock and commodity crop production impact the ability of peasant and small scale farmers around the world to access land, operate a viable farm, and feed themselves and their communities?
Well, the more that, it's just pretty clear that the more that this model, and with corporations now extending their arms, fingers in globally and buying up land that was often communally owned, that that is a huge threat to viability of people around the world. And on the positive, though, I want to underscore that one of the things that most thrilled me in writing the new introduction is being back in touch with Jules Preddy, who's a professor at the University of Sussex. And he has devoted his life to, with a whole team of researchers, some here in the U.S., devoted his life to identifying where are social groups being created, creating social groups, land-based, that are growing food sustainably. And so it's exactly the opposite, sort of the good side of the bad. And what he found was that just in the 20 years from 2000 to 2020, that there were 8 million new self-organized, this is what I call living democracy, where people are working in groups and cooperatively making decisions and growing sustainably. Whereas when this his counting began, there were just 500,000. So it was over this 20-year period, this enormous burst of very positive global movement. I don't know. I think he also has an estimate on what portion. I'm a little foggy on it, but the idea that was so encouraging to me was just this burst of energy in sustainable farming at a very local level with very, you know, small groups organizing themselves. And so I highlight a number of them in the new book and new chapter. And one of my favorite pieces of that is in one of the poorest parts of the world, in the Sahel region of Africa, very dry, just under, you know, just below the Sahara Desert, and where there's just been a takeoff of agroforestry, the combining of trees and crops in the same field, so they complement each other. And I could go on about that, but I just wanted to, I didn't really answer your question, but I did point to the, because the negative is the corporate expansion and monetization and privatization of land. But on the other hand, there is this large and growing global movement of more cooperation and sustainable farming that I want to learn how to be even a better supporter of, articulator of, because that is what has inspired me. I know my daughter Anna and I, we got to go to visit the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, which is one of the leading lights of groups that are moving and risking their lives to move and to take land that had been just idle land owned by the biggest landowners in Brazil, and now growing in cooperatively growing healthy, sustainable crops. So I that's the part that we don't hear a lot about. And I just wanted to give our listeners that that thrill.
Interesting. You're talking about Brazil. Also,
we have courageous people.
Yeah. Brazil also has the largest vegan movement of any country right now. I mean, they're the biggest meat eaters. They're huge meat eaters, but they also have the largest growing vegan population, I think, in the world. I found that.
Wow.
There was an article in New York Times.
I wish I'd known that.
A while ago. Yeah. They have a really big vegan movement there, which that's, I was really surprised by, because you always think of Brazilian food as, you know, very meat-centric.
Oh, absolutely. So. When Anna and I visited, I remember it was really hard. It was 20 years ago. And it was really hard to avoid big slabs of meat. But
it's changed.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the fake meat movement. You know, the alternative meats that are out there. Not so much the growing meat in a petri dish, because that's absurd also. But I'm really talking about the plant-based meat alternatives that are out there now. Some of them are genetically modified, some of them aren't. What's your take on that? You know, is that, do you think that's a better alternative? Do you think that's heading in the right direction? Or anyway, what's your thoughts?
Well, I'm an expert in this at all, but I do have read enough to know that there are a lot of additives in these products and they're highly processed. So in no way do they really address the key spirit of all of my life's work in Europe, that we are embracing a much more satisfying and life-supporting and pleasant way of cooking. And we don't have to just substitute one deadly product for something that is not so bad for us, but it reminds us of what we've lost or something. I don't know. I just think it's not the way to go, because one, you know, as I say, we don't really know what's in it. There are a lot of additives. And I know when I reached out to groups to advise on this, there's something they mentioned called heme. Do you know what heme refers to? I don't.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's an additive. I just think that what you represent and what and you embody in all of your teaching and all your work, that this embrace of we can do this and we can just be experimenters in the kitchen and find what really appeals to us and explore the taste wonders of the textures and colors and tastes in the plant world, and all of this idea that, oh, we just got to replicate a burger that's not so wasteful or harmful. It just not the right direction. Mm-hmm. We're still trapped into that processed, preformed, and that's disempowering for people, I think, in the kitchen. So that's my, biggest issue, that why I don't think that is a very helpful direction.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the food system impacts of the free market capitalism? How does it impact our democracy and decision-making power? now?
Well, as I said, I don't believe we have a free market because markets require rules to keep them open so that there is real competition. And when we have such monopoly control in our food system at every level, I don't think there is true competition. And I think anyone who has access to any kind of cooperative or farmers markets or any way that we can avoid the big chains, the better. So I push back on that label of free market. And what I think of it as a one rule market, you do what brings highest return to existing wealth. So you end up with such concentration now in the US that three people control as much wealth as the bottom half of the population. So it's so wild that we think that with this degree of inequality and families struggling at the bottom on a minimum wage that you can't live on, that people can have the time and the wherewithal to buy fresh food and to cook whole foods. I mean, clearly in this extremely unequal society where the market is so monopolized that free market is just a myth, it's very, very difficult, especially for low-income people, to do what you and I are talking about today is really this helpful whole foods approach. So it has to be all, we have to be working in a systems, a relational point of view, not just one intervention, but seeing everything in relationship to all else. And that when I say that, I think of my friend now deceased, the German physicist, Hans-Peter Dürer, who once said to me, Frankie, in our systems, there are no parts, there are only participants. Whether it's biology or human society, there are no parts, there are only participants. And so everything is connected to everything. And therefore, to really live fully, we have to be weighing in whatever we can to elucidate how unfair and unfree our market is, how it concentrates. We have one of the most extreme concentrations of wealth in the world. We are more unequal than about 100 countries. I mean, we think of ourselves as something much better than that. So I don't have a simple answer to your question, but I think it starts with telling the truth about who we are and how our economic system works. And then recognizing that we've got to work harder to make sure that every neighborhood, no matter what income quintile, every neighborhood has markets where they can access fresh food. And that and local food and non-chemical food. So that has to be part of the agenda. And I hope going forward, we can get much, much better at that.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen the growth in food cooperatives where people are cooking in groups? I mean, I know in the city I've read about, you know, groups like within an apartment building taking turns. I cook Monday, you cook Tuesday, you know, to try to help people eat healthy who don't have time to cook every day. And also, you know, sometimes it's not that much harder to cook for eight than it is to cook for four.
Right.
You just double it. So have you seen a rise of that? Because I really would love to promote that.
Yes. I'm not following it, but it makes perfect sense. And I often say to people, if you want to make the shift to more plant-centered eating, that find a buddy, you know, even one friend who wants to experiment with you and trade recipes and trade dishes with you and share meals with you, you know, save leftovers and share leftovers. I think that spirit is so inviting and so reinforcing, because in any, you know, we take any new step in life, it's so great to not be alone in that. I stress that a lot at the end of my new chapter in Diet for Small Planet, that courage means stepping outside of our comfort zones, you know, and what our peer group is doing and being a little different. And that's scary. But if we can find one ally, you know, somebody gutsier than we are, who will take our arms and walk with us, it makes it so much easier. So I really love that. And obviously, if you're in an apartment building, it's much easier than if you're in a single family. Yeah. But why not? Wherever you are, you know, talk to your friends. If you have friends in the neighborhood, you can walk to share in that way. I think that's brilliant.
Yeah. I remember, you know, when my kids were young, it made such a difference, the fact that I had other vegetarian friends. So my kids, we'd go to parties, you know, everything was okay to eat. You know, we didn't have problems until they started going to school and was introduced to all these other kids that ate candy and all this other stuff that, you know, my kids didn't so much participate in. So, you know, it's really supportive when you have community around you, and finding that community is very helpful. So I encourage that a lot as well. So let's talk about the concept of freedom and redefining freedom. How do you talk about that? And, you know, of course, in your democracy movement as well, I'm sure that comes up a lot.
Yes, I think that is key, because we so identify this nation with that concept that we freed ourselves from our colonial power and the freedom. Yeah, the freedom value is so central to our identity. And so I begin with, what is freedom but actually having real choice? That bottom line is, if you don't have choices, then wow, can you talk about freedom? And right now, because of the extreme inequality in our country and what goes with that in closing off opportunities for choice, whether it's where you live or where you send your kids to school or where you shop, how much access you have to healthy food, all those limit your choices because we have such an extreme concentration of wealth and don't believe, as many other countries do, in just making sure everybody has at least the basics. So I think it's so important to change, to get our self-image aligned with who we really are, and to realize that there are other countries that we can learn from. You know, I was just reading the paper today about what they're suggesting for the Biden plan, how it could help people with kids to have childcare. And these are things that are just taken as a norm in much of Europe, right? That you have access to early childhood education and to your pre-K is available. Childcare is available to you, and at a price that doesn't just totally wipe out your total salary that you've earned that day. So I think the attaching this idea of freedom to real choice, that only we, as working for the general welfare, can create a society in which all of us have real choice to live our values and take care of our families, and including feeding ourselves and our families well. That is the definition of freedom. It's not freedom just from, you know, we've been taught, oh, from Ronald Reagan on, freedom is just eliminating government, you know, that government is the obstacle to freedom, rather than seeing government as actually our tool. Who should government be answering to but the citizens? And I'll just tell you one little anecdote about my life. I marched from Philadelphia to Washington, D.C. in 2016 in what we call Democracy Spring, for the very reforms now that are being put forth in Congress for, you know, voting rights protection and anti-gerrymandering and getting money out of politics. And we marched. I didn't think I could walk 10 miles, and I marched over 100 miles. And as we approached the Capitol, Bhavani, I looked up, and there was the dome. And I started weeping. And my buddy, Adam Eichen, who I wrote a book with, 49 years my junior, we both started weeping at the same time. And we realized later, we got all teary because we looked at the Capitol and we said, wait, those people in there, they work for us. They work for us, you know? And that sense of power that we often, just looking from afar, we feel so much like vassals, you know, from a feudal time, when actually our system puts us in charge if we take that energy and take that grounding that we're given in law, but often fail to act on. So it's just really an exciting moment of empowerment that I haven't lost yet since 2016, that shift that now, you know, there's voting rights legislation up for grabs here in Massachusetts. And if you go to democracymovement.us, you can see in wherever you are, you know, what are the key democracy reforms that you can participate in that can further your causes around everything this show is about and other values that you have.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, you talk about freedom right now. Our country is so polarized. I've never experienced it as polarized as this, and it's so sad. But for so many, it comes around freedom. You know, I have so many friends that, you know, have pulled their kids out of public school because of the vaccination mandates. you know, I remember when I sent my kids to school, you know, I did not do all the vaccinations. I did some, you know, but I was free to research and make an educated decision for my children as to which vaccines I felt were good and which ones were okay. You know, if my kid got the mumps, okay, or chicken pox, okay. You know, I remember getting the chicken pox as a kid and my mother calling all my friends to come sleep over so that they could get the chicken pox, because we wanted our kids to get the chicken pox so that they'd have the immunity. and now all the vaccinations, you know, it's scary. And so I know people, you know, the Waldorf school where my kids had gone, you know, many of the kids weren't vaccinated, and yet I had to do a religious exemption and actually lie saying that they had no vaccinations because I wasn't allowed to say I gave them some and not others. Either you don't believe in vaccines or you do, for religious exemption. And now, you know, with the vaccine for the pandemic, you know, there's so many different feelings, and then with the abortion rights coming into it, it's like, you know, and people are saying they want freedom, and yet they want freedom for one thing but not freedom for the other. It's just a mess.
No, I think this is a concept of freedom. I think we should have common ground, take the initiative on that and really redefine it. You know, freedom as real choice in our lives, and in terms of jobs, that having choice of a job that pays enough to support your family, in terms of living in a place where you have greenery around you so that you can be healthier. I mean, to really claim freedom for these values of opportunity, of health, of freedom from disease and hospitalizations when you can avoid it by eating well. So I think, anyway, I'm going to try to continue to reclaim that concept. It's not just against something, but for something very powerful, which is choices that make us healthy and are good for the earth, which we all depend on. None of us are free if we're decimating species and frying the planet, right? We're going to all be limited, very limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, right now, you know, we don't have the freedom to tell the industrial food system to stop doing what they're doing, because they're ruining all of our topsoil too. I mean, we're not even going to be able to grow vegetables down the road at the rate that they're ruining the topsoil. So
yes,
lots of work to do.
Yes, yes, yes. And I think food is such a great way to start, because we all love to eat and to talk about food. And I think it's just a great entry point into all these complex questions.
It's a common ground. We all eat food. So I'm going to share all of your links. If people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to reach out?
The best way to reach out to Small Planet?
Info at
smallplanet.org. And
okay, great.
We have the smallplanet.org website, and there's also a dietforsmallplanet.org website. And then we also have the democracymovement.us website. So,
well, I'll share all those links on my website and newsletter so that everybody listening will have access to that. And thank you so much for making the time to join me today.
Oh,
you're an inspiration
for me. Pleasure to see you again. Oh, Bhavani, thank you. It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you. And everyone who's been listening, thank you so much for joining us. And I'll see you all again next week. Bye for now.